And welcome, gentle listener, to The Talking Show. Kaechung Radio, Chinatown's only micro-broadcasting radio station's only all-talking, all-the-time radio show.
Tonight, we have an encore presentation of David Anton, our first episode here on The Talking Show. So please, sit back, relax, and enjoy the sweet voice of David Anton.
Okay, so we're...
Make sure that thing is on over there. Yeah. No,
it's
that
all
guy.
Plugged in.
That one?
You got that?
And
you got that?
Yep.
Paper. Yeah, okay. All right. Hi. Hello, listeners to Kaechung Radio in sunny Los Angeles' very own Chinatown, and welcome to the very first edition of this talking show. I'm one of your hosts, Steve Cato.
And I am the other, Nicholas Miller.
And we've got some great talking for you today. We've got some fantastic talking for you. Let me just say that we're broadcasting live. That's right, L-I-V-E, live. From Los Angeles. Nick and I are both here. We haven't actually seen each other in a couple weeks. We've been really busy with other stuff.
No, we haven't.
So this is just one of the first chances Nicholas and I have gotten to be together in the last little while.
Right.
It's just really great to see you, Nick. I'm so happy we're working on this together.
Yeah, Steve, it's always a pleasure working with you and really good to see you. You're looking remarkably healthy.
Yeah, and you know what? That's a great bow tie you're wearing. It really complements your jaw. It's really good on you there. You look great.
You're too kind, Steve.
So anyway, we're here in the studio, live, looking at the eggshell crates on the wall that are, you know, making this room the acoustic marvel that it is. And to prepare you a little bit for our amazing guest, our special guest today is none other than David Anton, famous for his talking. I think he's going to do some really great talking. So buckle your seatbelts and, what's that, Nick?
You know, I just wanted to say to our listeners, we've been talking for a really long time and it's an important thing that we do. You know, and I'm really excited for this David Anton work because he is an excellent talker.
Uh-huh. And so buckle your seatbelts, sit back and relax and enjoy David Anton on Kaechung.
Thanks, Charles, for that marvelous and generous introduction with which I have no quarrel except to say that I have always had a very high regard for your work as well, and like the conversation we did together, always felt to me like a conversation that we both invented together in relation to each other's work, and the disjunctiveness of generations, of like a 20-year separation of generational being, and maintaining a bridge across the generational, complex generational divide. It was a very beautiful experience for me to be conversing with Charles over email over a 3 or 4 month period. And Charles was a kind of like marvelous co-conspirator in the construction of the book. But in any event, I'm coming to the point that with this particular talk, I have been having in mind a question of how can I separate Freud from psychoanalysis? Because I think that psychoanalysis has come to a kind of, itself has come to a kind of
repeat broadcast!
A weak dead end as a therapy, as a, you know, there are people for whom it works and people for whom it doesn't work. It's not a science that Freud had imagined it to be. It's something else. And there is a great deal of important thinking that Freud does, which if you leave him within the psychoanalytic framework, you obscure his major contributions to real. Am I not holding it close enough? I see. I got to learn how far it is. You know, like I'm not used to being a chanteuse. Anyway, in a certain sense, I'm attracted enormously to the three major books that argue for the presence of unconscious cogitation of some order or another, which got nominalized and concretized into the notion of the unconscious, which is kind of funny. Most of Freud's suggestions in those three books are more suggestion-like and more tentative than his translators have allowed him to be, particularly his English translators. For example, there are imaginary terms that are introduced by either Ernest Jones or Brill. For example, for many years when I was reading him back in high school at some point, I was interested in them as a psychoanalytic thinker, and I had to wonder, what the hell was a cathexis? When somebody said, his thinking undergo a libidinal cathexis, so I figured, screw this, I read German as well as I read English, I'm going to find out what he said. And what he said was, what he referred to was a Besetzung. Now, when something is Besetzung, if you are flying Lufthansa and you want to go to the bathroom and it's occupied, the sign says Besetzt. So it also, an army that invests a city, it surrounds a city, the city may be occupied, the occupation of a hostile city, the city is Besetzt. Now, that doesn't sound to me like cathexis, which sounds like an imaginary Greek term that you can't follow the meaning of in any serious way. And this runs throughout the account. I mean, Freud never had a word, the id. What the hell is the id? It's Latin for it. And Freud called it the it, you know? He called it the it, the I and the it. Whatever the it was it. So I realized that even then, as I was reading him in high school and I was trying to figure out what the hell he had in mind, I had to read him in German to be able to follow what in the world he was saying. Recently, somebody gave me a copy of a rather very good book, Why We Laugh. A French psychoanalytic scholar was talking about his book, Witz und ihre Beziehung zur Unbekannt, that is to say, wit or jokes and their relationship to the unconscious. Now, it's very funny because Witz doesn't translate neatly into anything either. It doesn't translate directly into jokes. Sometimes it means strictly a play on words, like punning. But he was dealing with all kinds of jokes. The only thing he was also dealing with, he was first dealing with Jewish jokes. Not too well known, although it is known that Freud in about 1895 was considering doing a collection of Jewish jokes and had collected a large number of them. In 1908, he burnt the collection. It is not entirely clear why he burnt it, but the book was intended to, the book about jokes and the unconscious was intended to generalize and universalize what might better have been rooted in a particular ethnicity and having the same relationship to universality than any ethnicity might have, but having a distinctive flavor. Because after all, Jewish jokes have a sound of great cynicism about them, which seems so typical of their character. And I was very interested in jokes, but it turned out I've been lately trying to figure out what Freud had in mind that is useful in this day and age to us in a meaningful way. And let me explain how I see this. I have long advanced a theory, more than 10 years ago, I advanced the theory of narrative, which changes the nature of the game. And if people accept it, it does something interesting. I've decided that, after long thinking about it, that it is better to think of narrative and story as two separate cognitive modalities, which are often intertwined with each other. And then I define story as a sequence of events and parts of events that lead to a significant transformation. So it's entirely a plot-driven style. And this is what almost all the critics and theorists talk about, is plot. Whether it's Roland Barthes or you name them, they're only interested in plot. And it seemed to me that I was interested in narrative in a way that they weren't. They seemed to help useless to me. Todorov and Barthes and family, that I wondered what it was that got them to deal only with the mechanic, like a Boccaccio story treated as if it were an O. Henry story. You know, everything going on, twists of a kind of logical and slightly surprising sequence. And I tried to examine what I meant, and what I thought I meant was central to all things I called narrative. It seemed to be they were those engagements of a desiring subject with the threat or promise, or threat and promise, of a transformation that this person or group of people, usually this person, would try to either bring about or to overcome and prevent. So if the storyline is essentially the external shell of narrative, and that narrative is the subjectivity confronting transformation, either positively or negatively, you're dealing with two different things that may be found together, but they may also not be found together. They may be found distinctively. For example, if you read a crime story in a daily newspaper, usually the crime story has been gotten from the desk sergeant, and who has taken the account of several witnesses and synthesized their account of what happened. And their accounts of what happened: a man came into the store with a drawn pistol, threatened the man at the register. $25. It was all that was in the till, and disappeared into an alleyway between two slum buildings. Now, this was probably the result of several different witnesses' accounts, and nobody's desire is really given. That is, there's no subjectivity at all in the account, because there's no subject. Subject in the sense that there's nobody experiencing. Nobody's desire is central to the shaping of the representation. And I said to myself, well, Freud has a case against narrativity in dreams, let us say, which interested me. It's a case against plot. That is to say, we have dreams, and he thinks the dreams are not narrative at all. His interpretation of dreams, published in 1900, had been worked on for 5 years, was part of an attempt to buttress his theory that there is some cogitation of a deeply emotional and free-thinking nature below the level of our awareness that he locates hypothetically in a place called the unconscious. And the system from which he draws the evidence that there is some thinking going on that is not conscious thinking, he draws from essentially from dreams. He draws them from legends, myths, and he draws them also from slips of the tongue. In the psychopathology of everyday life, he's dealing with errors made by people where they say something that they probably didn't want to say by what appears to be by accident, but which looks like the intervention of some demonic other who's making you say what you don't really want to say in public, but what you might very well think. So I began to ask myself, there's something strange about Freud's work. One of the things is he has a commitment to, which puzzled me at times, the notion, he insisted that all dreams are wish fulfillments. And this is the weakest spot in his theory of dreams, because as many patients pointed out to him, what about my nightmare? And the nightmare, he would say, well, the nightmare is really your completing your wishes, as it were, to prove me wrong. You're fulfilling your wish to prove me wrong by demonstrating a dream. It's not a wish fulfillment. So it's a wish fulfillment by not being a wish fulfillment. This didn't seem to me too clever an idea. And he's often been accused of being unscientific by proposing absurd answers like that in defense of his theory. But and it struck me that there is a different way to think about this. I think that he's right if we back him off his hyperbole. See, psychoanalysis is filled with hyperbolic thinking. If we back Freud off the hyperbole and say that all dreams are invested with desire of some kind or another, and let us imagine desire being a linear vector having two ends. For the sake of oversimplification, imagine it as a linear vector that can be directed toward one end of the vector or the other end of the vector, which would mean that it would pass through the origin and be a negative vector. Like a dream that was a nightmare would be the negative form of desire. It would still be desire, but it would be the negative form.
Repeat broadcast!
Better to think of desire having a negative form and a positive form, although it's more complicated than that. But in the greatest simplification, all Freud had to do was say the dreams are, in fact, always, in a sense, carried by some kind of desire. But that's not the kind of Freud that you have in 1900. Freud couldn't say things like that in the need to establish a so-called science and a therapy. It's too tentative. It's much more like being a thinker than being a doctor. Now, I think that basically also that Freud imagined the dream as a kind of assemblage, which is why it often appealed to, had a literary appeal even in its crudest forms, because there are elements that are not assimilable to story. And story so illogical that he can't accept it. Now, some of the things he called illogical were actually logical, but simply not conventional. I mean, Freud was rather old-fashioned about what he considered a clean-cut story, what he would call a clean-cut story. And the question is how often dreams are narrow. Now, I've always found that almost everything I've read
a very nice vintage Magnavox model D8300, yellow, black, large AM FM stereo boombox from the 1980s. The unit has seen very little use and has always been stored indoors. The unit works perfectly as new on every setting and function. No crackling in the volume or speakers. Sounds awesome. The unit is physically and cosmetically excellent, showing only very minor superficial scuffing on the corners and in the front lenses. They are only really noticeable in the right lighting. The unit has no broken, no missing parts or pieces, and no repaired parts or pieces. Has the original carry strap, battery compartment is spotless, and looks unused, probably because it uses 8 D-cell batteries. Also has AC power adapter cord. Absolutely no loss of graphics. All knobs are excellent and tightly attached. Original antenna with no defects. Speakers and grill are excellent with no dents or waves. The only thing keeping this from being a mint unit is the light scuffing. The unit has double cassette with dubbing control, AM, FM, mono, stereo, radio, 5-band equalizer, 5-speaker MDHQ system, built-in microphone and headphone jack, separate left-right volume control, and two rear external RCA jacks for extra speakers. The unit screams 1980s and measures just over 21 inches wide x 11 inches high with handle down x about 6 inches deep and weighs about 11 pounds without batteries. Extremely nice find in this condition. Absolutely no disappointments. A very nice vintage Magnavox model D8300, yellow, black, large AM FM stereo boombox from the 1980s. The unit has seen very little use has always been stored indoors. The unit works perfectly as new on every setting and function. No crackling in the volume or speakers. Sounds awesome. The unit is physically cosmetically excellent, showing only very minor superficial stuff on the corners and in the front lenses. They are only really noticeable in the right lighting. The unit has no broken, no missing parts or pieces, and no repaired parts or pieces. Has the original carry strap. Battery compartment is spotless and looks unused, probably because it uses 8 D-cell batteries. Also has AC power adapter cord. Absolutely no loss of graphics or decals. All knobs are excellent and tightly attached. Original antenna with no defects. Speakers and grill are excellent with no dents or waves. The only thing keeping this from being a mint unit is the light. The unit has double cassette with dubbing control, AM, FM, mono, stereo, radio, 5-band equalizer, 5-speaker MDHQ system, built-in microphone and headphone jack, separate left-right volume control, and 2 rear external RCA jacks for extra speakers. The unit screams 1980s and measures just over 21 inches wide, x 11 inches high, with handle down, x about 6 inches deep and weighs about 11 pounds without batteries. Extremely nice find in this condition. Absolutely no disappointments.
Probability to such a degree that the least probable things happen. Now, least probable things can
repeat broadcast.
Catastrophic changes do happen, and they happen in economic worlds. They also happen in psychological worlds too. And I wondered whether this was a kind of message to myself. Now, I don't believe I have a messenger underlying me, and I think it's unwise to suppose that the impulses that we're not completely in control of and that we partially calculated and perhaps even somewhat theorized, I don't believe that they're located in the subjectivity that's a single speaker. But for every point of desire, it seems to me that anything you desire comes with a consequence of its negative consequences. For example, Midas gets the golden touch, and he gets an awful lot of gold. But then when he starts turning people to gold that he didn't want to be turned into bars of gold, he got the negative side of the gold rush. Now, if you suppose that every choice we make comes with, it's like the Jewish joke about Mrs. Goodman, who is in Florida, enjoying her services she was paying for. She was getting her toenails painted and clipped, and there was a young glamorous woman sitting next to her, who said to her, "Mrs. Goodman, that's a beautiful diamond ring you have there." And the woman says, "Yeah, you like it." And she says, "It's okay." She said, "But it comes with a curse." It comes with a curse. What's the curse? Mr. Goodman. Now it seems to me that all good things come with their level of curse. You never know, and you're never sure what they are. But all good transformations can also be hostile transformations, and it would have seemed to me that you could always imagine the dream had something to do with the anxieties that would be produced in the stock market by the random walk theory, which I had considered as a problem that would have been obviously not appropriate for. On the other hand, that's not a personal thing, except that I was sort of speculating about that. The other thing is, it seems to involve something about how much involvement I would have in an academic situation that was presented to me by somebody else. Why would I be concerned with the behavior of a university that I was not a member of, I was not really committed to? Well, there was the appeal of the handsome young Indian, which at first seemed to me a perfectly logical panic. I understood, but then suddenly he's trying to make out with the mathematician who is designated as the one who could conceivably help him. So this Indian figure begins to take on the shape of some kind of curious hustler, into whose hustle I'm being, as it were, swept. And there's something funny about it. My image of my relative neutrality is being blurred by my intended helpfulness, which is perhaps excessive. I think it was less, but thinking back about the emotional tone of it, I don't think I was, I think I was I was helping him, but helping him, I still wanted to know how anybody could solve the problem. because it didn't seem like a soluble problem. It didn't seem like there were enough elements in it to produce even a set of equations. So the question would have to be, using my poet's association method, why an Indian? Why this sort of the handsome Indian guy and the handsome Indian mathematician? What are these Indians that are here? Does that mean something to me? And I suppose it meant something about the attractiveness of the university, relaxing and accepting the existence of more than the white, the white WASP professor, accepting something different, which I found intriguing, but a little baffling, because he was baffling. If he was a representative of an Indian academic, it isn't a fair representation. But of course, no one said dreams should be fair. So was I imagining something about the relationship to this or not? I don't know. But in a certain sense, the enigmatics of the circumstance are not such to throw me off from calling it a narrative. To me, it's still a narrative. I desired a solution to, what I desired was a solution to the problem. I wanted to see what sort of dazzling solution could be produced for this rather indeterminate-looking problem. And that seemed to be the core desire. Now, Freud could have said that's not really the case, but what he would have no better evidence than I would. Now, it seemed to me that when we look at Freud again from this point of view, that his free association method is nothing other than a kind of playful associative thinking, he could have assumed also, and probably should have assumed, that the unconscious was not a so integrated as space. In other words, if we're really talking about the mind going underground, so to speak, that is to say, not being fully self-aware of what it is doing and nevertheless doing it at the same time, it's less of a metaphysical existence. It's not like the unconscious is a place. It's simply a way of talking for convenience about the way in which we sometimes are thinking things that we are not completely aware of, and then sometimes become aware of them, or become aware of them in fragments. Now, Freud, again, that doesn't make for good therapy. I don't know whether psychoanalysis is therapeutic success is a matter of some dispute anyway, but it doesn't lead to a science. What it leads to is thinking. And the question is how to think about it, how to think about the nature of unconscious cogitation. If Freud were to have said it's a place commonly generated, it's a kind of thinking commonly that one would call metonymic thinking. If it was a place that was deeply filled with metonymic thinking, where things are as freely associated with each other, and free association essentially is a description of thinking by metonymy, of juxtaposing elements into a kind of proximity with each other rather than have logical.
Repeat broadcast!
Astrophysicist and mathematician, and it was his description of a random walk that I employed in definitions in the Black Plague. Certain probability. Random walk coming to an end at a wall. Am I too low?
Oh, no, I think it just wasn't. It feeds back when you're talking.
What's the story? All right, I'll just keep it closer. I keep putting it, lowering it, because I keep thinking that this way I'd have to sing. But in any case, if you suppose you technicize the unconscious, You simply unspecialize it becomes a different thing. It becomes more productive. That is to say, we all have dreams that are so clearly narrative that I remember one of the most dreams I was struck with most were of my own was a dream that I had as a teenager when I was being convinced that I was really a writer. And I had great anxiety about being a writer, not about the ability to write well, but about the radical necessity for doing things that might be embarrassing or peculiarly disloyal seeming. And I remember this dream of like a friend of mine and I are in a forest and we're running away. We're running our way through the forest and are being pursued by animals more or less made out of pipe cleaners. And these pipe cleaner animals that you can see through are pursuing us. So I say, let's lie down and play dead. And we lie down on the floor of the forest among these deep leaves. And the pipe cleaner animals come and sniff at us and figure we're satisfactorily inert. And they move away. And we get up and continue our search. And we come to a mausoleum, a small marble bungalow, so to speak. And near the door is a lab sheet. And it says, and the lab sheet that says, press, make the entry point right at the sternum and cut downward vertically. And it goes on in this manner. And my friend who was standing behind my back reading it also says, your own grandmother? And I say to him, never believe that the white keel of the body is heir to the living flesh. Man is a spirit. And then I start laughing. So, if this isn't a narrative, I don't know what is a narrative. And Freud has narratives like that too. Freud tells a story which has narrative force of a patient of his who had an unfortunate affair with a woman of dubious reputation. This is I'm giving you his the relationship came to know they finally separated. And it was thought to be an improvement of his situation. And somehow or other, he was part of a theatrical group, which doesn't follow from anything else. He was part of an amateur theatrical group that were performing a play in an inn in the suburbs of Vienna. And they were performing the play, and in order to costume themselves, there were not enough places to change. So some of the people were changing for their costumes in the upper floor, and others on the bottom floor. And when they had to then come change after the performance, the people in the upper floor seemed to finish putting their clothes on faster than the people on the bottom floor. And the people on the bottom floor were angry at them for making them wait so long to be able to, the people on the upper floor were angry because the people on the bottom floor were taking too long and they couldn't come down while they were disrobed. Now, all I can say, this is, of course, very funny. Theatrical people seeing each other nude, it doesn't seem somewhat commonplace, but perhaps these were rather uptight theatrical people in the dream. In any case, finally this is resolved in some way or another according to Freud's account of the dream. And then he's walking home to Vienna, and suddenly he's finding it harder and harder to move. He can hardly barely lift his legs, and he comes to a nearly complete stop, unable to go on, until an elderly gentleman comes and walks beside him and starts bad-mouthing the king of Italy, at which point he can breathe much better and he walks all the way back to Vienna. And now the interesting thing is this. Freud deals with the dream extensively, and he has a lot of interesting things to say about it, but he never once mentions the relevance of the king of Italy or even the event, as it was as if it didn't happen, because it might have had narrative significance. For example, I don't know what the date of the dream was, but Italy's unity was rather fragile at this particular period of time. And Italy and Austria were, in a certain sense, enemies and rivals over a certain part of the geography, which Freud doesn't bring up either. And you kind of wonder, how much is Freud, leaving out of what would make this a clearer-cut narrative as to why wittily he would be relieved to hear this guy bad-mouthing the king of Italy? Yet Freud never even tries to take it up. Now, this is a kind of fear of narrativization and a kind of desire to see these works as less intelligible than they are. And it seems to me... narratives were formulaic systems of plot systems. Once you start narrative as a kind of engagement of a subjectivity with the threat and promise of transformation, you turn around and you say, well, look, Linda Ginian is a narrative poet. She's not a story poet, she's a narrative poet. In fact, most of my friends turn out to be much better at narrative than at storytelling. And that seems, but I'm not profoundly interested in the story as in relation to a subjectivity. And so in a certain sense, it seemed to me that Freud was what I called a representational anti-representationalist. And he was part of a kind of modernist sensibility, which if once you begin to realize it, the extent, you go back and back him into his intellectual space, you realize he's a great writer, that the interpretation of dreams is a magnificent autobiographical work. And it's a defense of his the method, but he over-defends because of the number of enemies he had. That at that time, the whole idea of investigating the psyche was problematic enough, and particularly in ways, and other things he did were to conceal sources of things deliberately for some reason or other. Freud, when he was writing The Interpretation of Dreams, was also compiling a book of Jewish jokes. Now, this is rather curious. When you learn this, you've also learned that Freud at one point was asked, do you know Yiddish? And he said, I never studied Yiddish. So it was taken to be understood that Freud didn't know Yiddish, which seems to me to be very funny. And because one of the points that was made about his ability to speak Yiddish was made by Theodore Reich. And a friend and associate, a young disciple and an associate, Reich had visited Freud's home several times, and he said the problem was that Freud's mother spoke no other language than Galician Yiddish. Now, Freud, who apparently had a deep and profound relationship to his mother, had to speak to her in some language she understood, because she didn't understand German. And he must have spoken Yiddish. Now, that he wasn't this, but that, of course, relates also to the kind of problem that of the anti-Semitic attitudes toward Yiddish in German intellectual community. Yiddish was considered a jargon, that is to say, an incoherent creole, which is fine enough for what it is, but it isn't at all. Yiddish was a language. That was in linguistics. When I was in linguistics, we had a theory of dialect and a theory of language. It was said that a language is a dialect with an army. And ultimately, if you have an army, you have a language. If you don't have an army, you've got a dialect. And I believe this is quite true. But the evidence, the historical studies of Yiddish have in fact demonstrated that Yiddish as a language seems to have existed before standard German. That is, it seems to have come to be in late medieval period, but earlier than the formation of standard German, which was formed out of a Bavarian dialect. And whereas Yiddish was essentially a kind of hybridized Rhenish. That is to say, it was from the Jewish population that it emerged from Romance language backgrounds, probably Andalusia originally, and they had moved into southern France and then migrated from southern France into Germany and stopped at the Rhineland, where Yiddish took its first form. And as they were invited into Poland and Russia, rather colorful vocabulary of the Slavic vocabulary that is so much a part of it. The Hebrew vocabulary it always had, so it had a kind of, you know, that in Yiddish there are always two words for almost everything. One of them is the Hebraic word, and one of them is the Germanic word. For example, war is a krieg, which is the German word, or else it's a malchama, which is the Hebrew word. And you can have your pick, but it depends what audience you're aiming for. And I remember going to a reading of the poem of the stories of Sholem Aleichem by a Yiddish American Yiddish critic, who gave a reading, and I can usually understand English. I couldn't understand his dialect. I couldn't figure out what, because it was so Hebraic. Hebrew was a language I don't know, and it was so Hebraic, I didn't know what the hell he was saying. But if someone spoke to me in Yiddish in the street, I would have no difficulty understanding them. So apparently, my Yiddish is seen as verdeutscht, that is to say, Germanicized, because I spoke German before I spoke any Yiddish. And the Yiddish critic, was essentially deeply embedded in the Hebraic background that almost all young Jewish boys were embedded in, willingly or not willingly. In any case, Freud's anxiety about Yiddish creates a kind of complex duplicity, because many of the dreams he describes in the book on the Traumdeutung were in fact must have been told in Yiddish, and they involve all sorts of Yiddish things. Like there's one dream that I remember him talking about, a dream about a merchant whose wife wanted to eat what was considered a great treat, which was something that you would call salmon mayonnaise, a mayonnaise salmon, which essentially is lox in Yiddish. Lox is spelt but not pronounced like the verb to laugh, which is lachen, L-A-C-H-E-N. So Freud, in that story, reveals the fact that laughing was part of it, but he used, but lachen is also German, and Germans eat lox also, so he didn't get trapped in the Yiddish. On the other hand, he had stories that were so completely Yiddish that they might have been very difficult for anybody to translate. You wonder how he translated them into German. There's one particular story that he tells about two shtetl people. One of them more kind of, sort of disreputable looking than the other. And Morris looks at, they're about to take a train ride somewhere, and Morris looks at Shmuel and he says to him, "Shmuel, did you take a bath?" And Shmuel says, "Why, is there one missing?" So now that's terrific as long as you do it in German and Yiddish and French, where you can plané en bas, en bain. But if in languages where you can't take a bath, the pun won't do you any good. So I kept wondering to myself, how hard did Freud work to try to
be
capable of being translated into funny stories? How did he do it? And I would love to have seen that collection of Yiddish stories, but of course in 1908, according to all authorities, he destroyed it. According to, they say he burnt it, which I guess he threw it in the oven. Sort of a polluting way to deal with it, but an act of violence that seems to me somehow more interesting than simply throwing it away. So I think, in a sense, the belief that he had to universalize, he had a science in hand to universalize, whereas thinking knows no nationality. That is to say, if he's a thinker, he doesn't have to be, he can think in Yiddish if he wants to, and nobody will scold him. I mean, a Yiddish philosopher, Yiddish as well as he will in High German, and or in clear-cut Hungarian, in beautiful Hungarian, or in lovely Russian. So it seems to me that Freud's need for respectability, which is understandable, and his scientificization of stuff, his efforts to scientize, cuts him off for us as long as we keep thinking of psychoanalysis. What we should try to do is think of what he's really doing, and where the meaning of it lies that is not dominated by the scientism that he espoused and very seldom really obeyed. I mean, he really was not as systematic a thinker. He was a much more poetical thinker. And I must say, the one thing that I think is, of course, they reified his metaphors. In some way, it was like terrible reification that did him in, and still does him in. And you have to unblock it. You have to get rid of so much that it seems like a hard job, but it's worth it because he's a magnificent thinker. He He's a much better thinker than a doctor. Well, considering his relationship to cocaine, I think he actually, with very little reliability, he became slightly a cocaine addict, and persuaded people to ease their pain or to stay awake at school if they were having trouble staying awake. Cocaine would help them. And apparently a number of people suffered badly from the cocaine recommendations, so it became a kind of dark space in Freud's life. But in a certain sense, it was typical of Freud's rashness or boldness, whichever way you want to say it. There's a sort of boldness to accept the new and to try it out and see what it did. And he had to give up. I mean, there is an astonishing place at which he's away from his future wife, and he's writing to her, "But you're bold, you know, but your bold Siggy will be coming back full of happy cocaine." You know, it makes him feel more like a member of his contemporary poetic community. In a way that you would hardly expect. And I say, for me, the work, the unpacking of the work, accessible because of great taboos. His doctrine of censorship is essentially presented as a total figure of speech. When he talks about the dreams as having to pass through a censor, one sentence where he says if, and then they forgot the as if. It's as if we were blocking some. In fact, you get the impression from says, "I want this." I wanted to look like a great scientist, and I had made a mistake, and I wanted to look like I was the right one. You know, so what? Does the unconscious think, is it likely to think that a discontinuous metonymic form of thinking would be uttered by a kind of other, would be more or less located in its source in a scholar or a poet? Frankly, I believe that essentially what you have there is the work of one of the most brilliant German poets of the 20th century. People have comments or questions, I'm very, very pleased to answer or suggest answers or indicate my inability to answer them.
Wow. Okay, wasn't that incredible? What do you think, Nick?
Yeah, wow is right. I mean, it was fantastic, really fantastic. But to be frank, you know, it was all right there and so immediate that I just haven't had proper time to reflect on it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that's not to say that it wasn't sensational. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. Yeah.
I mean, David Anton is a perfect example of top-notch talking. I mean, really top-notch.
Well, it's funny that you say that. Yeah. But unfortunately, we're out of time. Looking at the clock ticking down here in the studio. So hopefully we'll see all of you listeners out there in Chongqing Road next time. Until then, of course, this is The Talking Show with Nicholas and Steve. Drop by the studio sometime if you're in the neighborhood. We'd love to see you. Take care. Bye.